This is Nurse Gizzard News for the week of February 10th, 2020, and I'm your host, Rebecca Hartman Baker. Today's guest is Chris Samuel. Chris is an HPC systems engineer in the computational systems group at NERSC. He's lived and worked in 4 countries, on 3 continents, and in 2 hemispheres. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Chris, today's topic is SLURM. So, SLURM is probably to most users is kind of like a giant black box. So we just submit our jobs and then things happen.
Yeah.
So, magic, yes. So, can you walk me through a job life cycle?
Yeah. So, users will run commands like sbatch to submit a job. And that runs on login node typically, or sometimes if they're submitting from inside the job on a compute node, that needs to talk over the network to a control daemon. So the control daemon accepts the connection, and the command sends the batch script through along with whatever options you put on the command line. And the first thing that happens is that the submit filter, that's something that we have control over, looks at it and says, okay, so you're asking for KNON nodes and you're asking for a certain amount of time and you ask this QoS, and it'll make any adjustments that are necessary in there to match our internal set of queues, then passes it through the control daemon, and then that will put it into the list of all the jobs it has to run and gives the user back the job ID. Once it's in that queue, and that queue can be 20, 30, 40, 50,000 jobs long, sometimes longer, SLURM then has the job of figuring out what's the best way to run this workload on the machine to keep it as busy as possible, but also to give the users the best throughput. And the main thing it uses to work out what to run when is the priority of the job. Different queues have different priorities, set initial priorities. But just because you have a lower priority than somebody ahead of you in the queue doesn't necessarily mean you have to wait for them to run first. And that's because, you know, jobs ask for different lengths of time, different number of nodes, different architectures. They may have a job dependency. They mean, so in other words, one job may depend on another one running. And SLURM is looking at all this and working out the best order to run things in to get the highest priority jobs through first. But that necessarily means, because this all doesn't, it's like Tetris, it doesn't all fit nicely with no gaps. And so there are opportunities to do what we call backfill, where SLURM will say, okay, I've done my best with all of these jobs above this cutoff line we have for forward reservations, where it's planning when the job will start. And then it will say, okay, well, I've got this, all these other jobs below this, which don't meet that threshold, but, oh, look, this one fits into this gap, and I can start it here. And it will keep doing that and going down the queue through priority. So it's finding the highest priority job that will fit into one of these holes, and we'll keep doing that until it reaches the end of the queue. Now that, because we have so many jobs, and because especially the initial set of calculations is quite intensive, can take anywhere between 3 minutes up to a limit of 15 minutes to get through. And if it hits that 15 minutes, then it stops at that point and we'll start again. Because one of the main things it needs to prioritize is servicing user commands. So we don't want all of this thinking about what it's going to do to stop it being responsive to people. So SLURM, I think, has basically 3 main sets of things it's trying to do at the same time. One is deal with user commands about, you know, incoming jobs or what's the state of the queue. Then there's all of the workload it's trying to process and work out what to run when. And then there's starting jobs and ending jobs. And the only things it really has control over is running through the list of jobs to work out what to run when and starting jobs. You know, ending jobs will end when they do. So it can't plan on when that's going to be. It knows the maximum time it could be, but jobs often end sooner. And it has no control at all over incoming user commands. And so what happens then is, up to a point, SLURM will juggle all 3. And then when there's too much, it will cut off working out what to run when and concentrate on servicing user commands. So your job's coming to the queue, it's running through that queue, working out what to run. It says, okay, I found your job, I can fit into this hole, or your job's high enough priority, I can actually start it now. Put it onto the machine. So it sends a message out to the compute nodes that'll be running it to say, here, there's a job coming. Then sends the batch script to the designated batch node, which is usually the first one in the list. And then Slurm will configure the operating system, so the kernel parameters for the job, which is things like how much memory you've asked for, how many cores, if it's a shared node, and then start your job as you in that little allocation. And then you do whatever you do. Now, if you're running over multiple nodes, there'll probably be an srun in there, and it will talk back to the control daemon and say, I'm starting on X number of nodes, and often that's just all of the ones you want. And then the control daemon sends messages back out to those to start processes up, and then the replies come back to it, and then it goes back to SRAN and says, yep, done. And then your job will run, hopefully all complete successfully. At the end, those processes exit, the messages go back to the control daemon saying, these are finishing. Your SRAN gets told, it finishes, your batch script ends, and the Slurm daemons on the nodes start the job of clearing up after it, and then feeding back to the control daemon to say, okay, you can forget about this job now, it's all done. The information is put in the database daemon and it's tidied up. That's kind of the life cycle of a job. I mean, on our machine with things like data warp, there are other bits of functionality that will necessarily need to happen before and after the job, but that's really the way it works.
Okay. Well, that's a really good explanation of how it works. So, you mentioned, like, when your job runs, then all these things happen. But sometimes it takes a really long time for your job to run. So how does Slurm select when to run what?
So the Slurm has two schedulers in there. They're all in there. There's a primary scheduler and a backfill scheduler. Now, the irony for us is that virtually all our work happens in the backfill scheduler. The primary scheduler is looking at the very highest priority things, like interactive jobs. As soon as they come in, working at where can I run you, get you started as quickly as possible. And that gets run at the start of the cycle, but also can be triggered by other events later on. But then the backfill scheduler takes over, and it then has this priority ordered list. So you have an initial priority on your job submitted, and that slowly increments over time. And we have a threshold, the same before, above which Slurm will try and give you a forward reservation, which is it saying, I'm going to look at my plan into the future and work out where your job best fits and try and get you started as soon as possible. And it then takes this list ordered by priority and is running through that, working out when things start. As soon as it finds a job that can start now, it will start it. And it will also look for gaps, which is where backfill comes from. You know, you can think of having a big pile of jobs and all these holes, and you're shoving your spade into the jobs, picking the high ones off the top and filling up the holes with them so that you're keeping the machine as busy as possible. And that means getting to jobs as quickly as possible so that users get the results as soon as they can. And this, it runs through this list to the end, and then it starts the whole thing again. And that said, that can take anywhere between, I mean, since the last maintenance where we did a lot of work to try and improve the OS configuration for this, we are spending between 3 to 7 minutes doing a backfill cycle, which is good, but we want it to be better.
Okay. So what about, like, sometimes it seems like inevitably that, you know, I'm about to submit my job, but then somebody else just submitted 1,000 jobs before me. So now, do I have to wait for all those 1,000 jobs before my job is going to run?
No. So it depends on a number of things. I mean, for instance, you could have submitted with a higher priority QoS. So if the person in front of you submitted 1,000 jobs, submit them all as regular, and you submitted your single job as a premium job, then you will have a higher initial priority than they do. And so Slim will be looking at yours first. But even if it's the same priority or lower, Slim is configured to only examine the first N jobs of a user, because we don't want, they call it queue stuffing. It's not, in supercomputing, that's what they call it, but it's not meant to be derogatory about the way people are using, because that's a perfectly legitimate way to use a machine. It's the effect it has if you don't do this thing of looking only at the first N jobs of a user and then skipping on to the next and so on. And to be fair, it's not just the first N jobs of a user, it's association based. So it's the user plus the account, and that's what determines that. So if you submit 1,000 jobs in one account and then you have another higher priority one that you put a job in, then that one will get looked at despite you having another 1,000 jobs above it.
Oh, okay. So I can use premium to kind of cut the line?
You can, but at a cost, because you're flying first class.
Right, so it's more expensive.
Yeah, but there are other ways as well. So we have the Flex QoS, which is a way to say my job has a minimum time it can run for and a maximum time. And then Slurm will look at your job and the holes in the schedule that needs to fill. And then if your job will fit in there because the hole is bigger than your minimum runtime, it will collapse the actual runtime of the job to the size of the hole it needs to fill. So that means, again, your job is getting on sooner, and there's a discount for it because you are saying, I'm going to be flexible for this. Yeah. And that's really useful if you have an application that can checkpoint or save state itself. So I have a friend in Australia who is a molecular modeler, and he uses a code called NAMD that saves its state every defined number of cycles. And he has a workflow where he will put jobs on there knowing that they will get killed, and they will resubmit themselves after a certain amount of time, and they will carry on from where they left off.
Yeah, so that's a super great workflow if you can swing it.
Yeah, but your code has to be able to do that sort of state saving stuff.
Yeah, you have to have some checkpointing in there.
Yeah. And if you're writing the code yourself, then I would strongly encourage you looking at that. If you're using somebody else's code, well, if you know them, go and ask them.
True. There's also there's also other libraries that you can use.
Yeah. So I know DMTCP is one that NERSC has a strong interest in and is working with the developers on. And the idea there is that it's kind of like a wrapper that you can run around the application to allow the wrapper to take this, can save the state on the application's behalf without it supporting it itself.
Right. We're working on getting that working here at NERSC.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll have that really soon.
Yeah.
So speaking of things that are coming soon, are there future plans for Slurm?
There are always future plans for Slurm. So I don't know if people know, but as NERSC, we do fund elements of Slurm functionality that we need that we feel would also be useful in the broader community. So one of the things which fits into what we're talking about checkpointing, is in the next major version of Slurm, is the ability for an advanced reservation. Now, advanced reservation is different to forward reservation. Forward reservations are automatically handled by the scheduler. You have no insight or control over them. It's just how it organizes its schedule internally. An advanced reservation is where somebody fills out a form and it comes to you. It
comes to me, yes.
And you say, okay, well, this is what we're going to do and this is when it can run. And then you pass an instruction to us to say, can you create this reservation for this person? And that advanced reservation is basically setting aside a set of nodes for a person or project to use. And that has benefits for them because, you know, they have a, if they have a, say, an experimental workload they need to run in that time, they know they have a set of nodes available for them. The problem that can be with that is if, for you know, reasons beyond the experimenter's control, say it's like a nightly one for a telescope or something, an optical telescope that needs to process data for the next day, they might get clouded out that night and they have no data to process. Now, if the reservation is there overnight, then there's probably not going to be somebody around that's going to get bothered to delete it. And if it's a recurring reservation, it may be hard to delete it without deleting the ones beyond that. So one of the things we're paying for is a feature so that the person who is having the reservation can say, I can tolerate up to X amount of time after my jobs are submitted before they can start. That's a latency, if you like. And then users submitting jobs can say, in the way like time min works, okay, I must run for at least this amount of time before I'm eligible for preemption. And by preemption, we mean when the actual workload comes along, once you've hit that time limit, that agreed latency, then your job is killed and removed so the experimental workload can start running. Now, that means if they are clouded out and their reservation isn't used, your job will run for that period of time, or you know, many jobs can run in that period of time. So you don't end up with lost compute time because of that reservation. And if they do start a little late because the cloud's clear partway through the night, their jobs start, are submitted, your jobs run up to that threshold, they're killed, and then their workload can start. And so it's a quid pro quo between the person wanting the reservation and everyone else who could make use of that time.
Yeah, that sounds really cool.
Yeah. And that's really important because we know that NERSC is going to be supporting more and more experimental facilities with many different tolerances for latency and needs for real-time compute. And so this is an important step on that pathway to being able to support these better.
Yeah. So switching gears, Chris, how did you end up here at NERSC working as an HPC systems engineer?
It's a long story. Okay. So I got into computing as a kid, because I was growing up in the UK at around the time of what they call the 8-bit micro boom. So there was this time in the UK where all of these, there were home computers. They typically, you turn them on, they start at BASIC, and you know, there's a Commodore VIC-20, and there's Sinclair ZX81, and Spectrum, and all these, a whole plethora of these systems. And so I got really interested in them then. And then I did computer studies at school and computer science for A-levels. And then I went to university because I always had this intense love of astronomy and I wanted to do astronomy at university. And I went to and did my degree, but by the end of it I realised I was far more aptitude for doing computing than I ever had for the maths needed to do physics. So I ended up getting a job in the UK in computing. I worked at the university for a while, then I went to a government research centre. I got married to an Australian in the UK. We moved to Australia a couple of years later, and I applied for a job advert at a place doing advanced computing, and I went in as a network person, and they would just bring in their first Linux cluster, and this was 2003. And I'd been doing Linux for almost 10 years by that time. And I started helping out, and before long I was the person doing a lot of work bringing up their Linux cluster. So I then spent another 16 years in Australia doing HPC stuff. At one point, part of the group we brought up there for 6 months, the largest machine in Australia. And then, for a host of reasons, I lost my wife to breast cancer, and through, you know, after that, then I ended up in a relationship with a lady in the US, and then I found out that there was a position going here, and I applied, and 8 hours of interviews later, I was offered a position. So that's how I ended up here.
Well, I'm really glad you ended up here, even if it was for maybe sad reasons in some way. But I'm really glad you're here.
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, it's life is not always fun, but you've got to make the best of what you get.
Very true. All right, so finishing up, three things you want nurse users to know.
So I would say be mindful in how you use the system, because you can, and Sloan is doing its best to make sure the users get the best service. And that means that, as I mentioned earlier, it can end up deferring looking at what it's going to run next. And so if it does get overloaded with either user commands or lots of very short running job steps or jobs, then it can end up spending so much of its time processing those requests that it will completely stop looking at the schedule, because it needs to deal with these incoming commands and messages. And so you can end up with the machine draining of jobs because things are ending but nothing's getting started. So be aware of that and have a think about if you do need to submit lots of small jobs, whether there's a way to batch them up in a way to avoid the need for lots of continuous starting of jobs or job steps within there. And yeah, also avoid running SQ in the loop. That's, you know, also not much fun for Sloan. I think the other thing would be that Cori is a Cray system, and the architecture of the Cray does impose some restrictions on what we can do on how Sloan runs. So there are features such as the way the internal high-speed network runs, where a quiesce can happen, and that's where, because on a machine of Cori size, there's always something failing somewhere. It's inevitable on a large machine, no matter who makes it. Things break, and that can be something like an optical fiber fracturing and taking a link out. Now there's spares, but they have to be routed around, and while that happens, the Cray software has to stop the network and reroute everything, send that message to all the compute nodes, all the 13,000-14,000 of them, because there's service nodes in there as well, to get them to tell them how the network now looks. While that's happening, there's no network traffic on the internal network, so Sloan can't talk to anything, and it can mean that the control daemon is unresponsive for a period of time, and that can be up to a minute or a minute and a half, something like that. So there are things that happen on the system that we would love to be able to control, but we can't, and we mitigate the best we can. And we're constantly putting in things to try and make things perform as best we can as well, because we can't just take a modern machine with a much faster CPU and plug it in just for the control daemon, much as we would love to be able to do that. It's just not feasible. And the other thing is, don't be afraid to ask questions. If you do see strange behavior, often the users will experience issues long before we may see them. And we know we have issues at the moment where there's a particular odd situation can happen when you run an S run within an S batch, where occasionally it looks like a message gets lost and it looks like your S run has hung. And that's because the initial message to the control daemon from S run got through and you allocated those nodes to run on. And then the response to S run to say, okay, you can go, gets lost. And so S run says, oh, nothing happened, I'll try again. Now it gets through and gets told these nodes are busy. And the control daemon doesn't know that the S run didn't get the message back. And the S run doesn't know that the control daemon replied. A, there's no logging for that, so we have no insight into when that happens. But also, it would be very hard to design a system that would catch that. I have some thoughts, and I'm going to put in a suggestion to how we may work around this. But we don't know whether things we do help with this or not unless users tell us when it happens. So yeah, I would encourage people to tell us when they see odd behaviours. And it may be things that we say, yeah, okay, we know why this happens. It's not something we can fix. Or we can say, okay, that's a bug, we can get it fixed. Or we need to work out how to diagnose what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Well, those are three great things. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you.